The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine today, dated December the 21st, 2012. And as usual, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, An Impasse Over the Fiscal Cliff. What happened? With less than 3 weeks left for lawmakers to avert a fiscal crisis, President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner traded dueling budget proposals this past week, but came no closer to a compromise that would avert major tax hikes and spending cuts due to take effect January 1. In direct negotiations with Boehner, Obama and aides slightly lowered their demand for new tax revenue to $1.4 trillion and reportedly offered to consider an overhaul of the corporate tax code next year. Republicans made a counteroffer virtually identical to the one they made last week of $800 billion in new revenue, with no increase in the tax rate for the top 2% of wage earners. Boehner insisted that no progress was possible until the White House offered substantial cuts in Medicare and Social Security. "Where are the president's spending cuts?" said Boehner. Obama said he remained optimistic that a comprehensive deal could still be negotiated before year's end, but said Republicans must first agree to a tax rate increase on the wealthy. Boehner warned Congress not to make any Christmas plans, and Republicans expressed pessimism that a deal was close. "It's getting worse, not better," said House GOP Whip Kevin McCarthy, the Republican from California. And, of course, there's been recent news this week since The Week was published. There's still no agreement, but there apparently is some optimism that an agreement might be worked out. We'll have more details next week. Now, here's what the editorial said. "Obama is arrogantly demanding total Republican surrender," said the Wall Street Journal. "Some GOP lawmakers, spooked by the president's blackmail, appear willing to surrender on taxes first in order to strike a deal on modest entitlement cuts. But Obama's demand for both higher tax rates and limits on deductions is the worst possible deal for the economy. Just because Mitt Romney lost the election doesn't mean Republicans need to repudiate their core economic principles. They should stand up to this bully." Republicans are right that Medicare's ballooning expenses have to be addressed, said the Los Angeles Times. "But Medicare's problems defy easy solutions, and it would be wrong to force across-the-board cuts into a last-minute budget deal. Most of the program's costs are caused by the soaring cost of health care and by the health care system's gross inefficiency. Almost 40% of all Medicare spending, for example, is consumed by just 5% of recipients, mostly in the final weeks of life. We need true reform, not just spending cuts." Now here's what the columnist said. "Democrats should accept one Republican demand on Medicare to raise the eligibility age from 65 to 67, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. "Would it save a ton of money? No, but it would give the GOP base the appearance that they'd won a round of serious belt-tightening in Washington. Since Democrats could extract higher tax rates and other key concessions in exchange for the reform, it seems like a sensible bone to throw to the right." "Actually, that would be a truly horrible policy," said Duncan Black in USA Today. "Many seniors would retire without insurance, forcing them to buy private insurance or go on Medicaid. Any money the government saved from moving back the eligibility age would be more than offset by increased costs to individuals, employers, and state governments." Obama is absolutely right to insist on a tax hike for the rich, said John Judas in TNR.com. Not only is an increase in the top tax rate supported by the public, it would help, not hurt, the economy. A Rutgers University economist recently explained why increases in the top tax rate, like the one that preceded the Clinton boom, stimulate the economy. When the wealthy take home more money, they mostly stash it away rather than spend it. But when wealth is redistributed downward, the middle class spends it, exactly what's right for the economy. Despite all the doomsday rhetoric about the cliff, said Larry Kudlow in NationalReview.com, the stock market has actually risen over the past 2 weeks. Investors can see the obvious, which is that Obama has the upper hand in this post-election battle. It's inevitable that Republicans will have to make a strategic retreat and accept an increase in the top rate, perhaps negotiating it down to 37% instead of 39.6%. Republicans don't want to be the party of rich people, so it's better to yield ground today in return for some spending cuts and resume the battle over spending, taxes, and deficits in 2013. The next item from the main story section, the fight over Egypt's future. Secular opponents of Egypt's Islamist President Mohamed Morsi warned this week that the country was returning to dictatorship as Egyptians prepared to vote on a divisive Islamist-drafted constitution. In Cairo, thousands of the president's mostly secular opponents protested the proposed constitution outside the barricaded presidential palace, saying that the document paves the way for Sharia law. "They're not Muslims, they're extremists," protester Nihal Amin said of Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood backers. Morsi responded by signing an order allowing the army to arrest protesters. Egypt has undergone weeks of unrest since Morsi issued a decree placing himself and the Islamist-dominated assembly drafting the new constitution above judicial oversight. The president withdrew those edicts last week, but only after the assembly finalized its draft. The opposition urged Egyptians to vote no in December 15th referendum, but vowed to fight on if the charter is approved. "The constitution lays the groundwork for an eminently unfree future," said Frida Gittes in CNN.com. "It's littered with tiny seeds that can germinate into religious oppression, such as its declaration that Sharia law will be the cornerstone of national law, and its ban on insulting prophets and messengers, a clause that could be used to silence opponents." The Obama administration has acted as Morsi's enabler throughout the crisis, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. It failed to condemn him when he grabbed power through decree, and Obama has stayed silent on this deeply flawed constitution. It's crazy for Washington to appear to take sides against those who want a liberal, tolerant Egypt and for those who favor the Sharia, but that's where the administration has ended up. "Actually, the Constitution isn't that bad," said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. "It protects against arbitrary arrest, enshrines freedom of association, and limits the president to 2 4-year terms. That's why the No campaign is expected to win 30% of the vote at best. The document can be amended by a parliament that will be elected once the Constitution is approved. So if the opposition really wants to safeguard democracy, it needs to get its supporters off the street and into office." The next item is entitled, "Michigan Weakens Unions." Michigan Governor Rick Snyder this week signed sweeping right-to-work legislation, making his traditionally pro-union state the 24th in the nation to ban requirements that a worker pay union dues as a condition of employment. Thousands of union members demonstrated outside the state capitol in Lansing as the Republican-dominated House of Representatives passed the laws, which cover all private and public employees except police and firefighters. In signing the laws, Snyder said they prompted workplace fairness and equality. "Union members vowed to fight on. We're going to have a civil war," said Teamsters President James P. Hoffa. How fitting that the era of industrial unionization may be coming to a symbolic end in the same place it started, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Michigan, with its auto industry, is to unions what Florida is to sand. And for right-to-work laws to be passed there shows how drastically the power of unions has diminished. There's no mystery why, either. Snyder, a Republican reformer but not a bomb thrower, says he has watched 90 companies move into neighboring Indiana since it passed right-to-work laws earlier this year. The union movement is getting undone by simple economic realities. This isn't about jobs, it's about politics, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. As much as Republicans detest unions as economic actors, they hate them far more as political actors. Unions organize their members to vote for the Democrats, so when the GOP gets control of a state, it seeks to crush unions as one of the largest bastions of support for the opposing party. But it's workers that get hurt, said Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post. Studies show that right-to-work laws do not lead to higher employment rates. Instead, they simply result in lower wages as workers lose leverage to demand raises. Today, only 7% of private sector workers are unionized, which is why the gap between the incomes of owners and workers is larger than at any time since the New Deal. Right-to-work laws simply redistribute income from workers to owners. And now in the main story section of the Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. This week it's entitled, Gay Marriage, How Will the Supreme Court Rule? Antonin Scalia knew this day would come, said Michael McGow in the Los Angeles Times. Back in 2003, when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Texas law banning homosexual sodomy, the conservative jurist said in a furious dissent that the ruling would cause a massive disruption of the current social order, equivalent to legalizing bestiality and incest, and predicted that it would open the door to gay marriage. Sure enough, the Supreme Court agreed last week to wade into the most contentious civil rights issue of our times and hear two cases involving the constitutionality of gay marriage. Back in his chambers, a grumpy Scalia must be saying, "I told you so." When the court hears oral arguments in March, said Emily Bazelon in Slate.com, it will mark a pivotal moment in the nation's history. The court will consider challenges to the constitutionality of both the Defense of Marriage Act, sometimes called DOMA, of 1996, which prohibits the federal government from recognizing any state's gay marriages, and to California's Proposition 8, which banned same-sex marriage there. One possible outcome is a Roe versus Wade-like ruling that instantly makes gay marriage legal in every single state. Whatever happens, this is going to be big. The question is how big, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Though they deny it, the court's justices are exquisitely aware of the public mood and don't like to get out too far ahead of popular opinion. Over the past decade, public support for gay marriage has grown rapidly, as successful ballot initiatives in Washington, Maine, and Maryland recently proved. But 33 states still have laws banning gay marriage, and polls say 47% of Americans remain opposed to it. Thus, it's likely the court will seek to avoid another Roe-like backlash with a narrowly worded ruling that strikes down DOMA and Proposition 8, without deciding whether all gay Americans have a constitutional right to marry. Everyone knows how Scalia will vote, said Rod Dreher in the AmericanConservative.com. He just told an audience that moral objections to homosexuality are no less justified than moral opposition to murder. But on this sharply divided court, the inevitable 5-4 vote will be decided by the swing justice, Anthony Kennedy, and he's firmly pro-gay. Kennedy has previously written that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees a person's most intimate and personal choices, and that discriminatory laws cannot be based on moral disapproval. Unless he's changed his mind, gay marriage will be a constitutional right by this time next year. So don't be so sure, said Jeffrey Rosen in TNR.com. Historically, Kennedy has also been a champion of states' rights. He will join with the four liberals only if they limit their ruling to DOMA and California and do not nullify anti-gay marriage laws in the rest of the nation. That would be for the best, said Jonathan Rauch, also in TNR.com. I've been fighting for marriage equality since the mid-1990s, when the cause seemed crazy. But with stunning rapidity, Americans have come to see the fundamental fairness of letting gays marry the person they love. Polls are swinging our way, and we just won a public vote in three states, despite all the arguments and money our opponents can throw at us. A Supreme Court ruling mandating gay marriage in 50 states would only stir up an angry backlash and deny us the ultimate victory. Let us win this battle where it counts, in the hearts and minds of our straight fellow citizens. Now, from the main story section, we'll turn to the popular column, A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for donkey cheesemakers after tennis star Novak Djokovic purchased the entire 2013 supply of the rare delicacy from the Serbian donkey farm that makes it. Djokovic, who paid $640 per pound, plans to feature donkey cheese at his new restaurant chain. It was a good week for another bailout after more than 4,000 Americans signed a petition on whitehouse.gov calling on the Obama administration to nationalize the Twinkie industry to prevent our nation from losing her sweet, creamy center. And it was a good week for eating dessert if widely believed predictions that the world will end on December 21st come true. The U.S. government felt obliged this week to note on its official website, scary rumors about the world ending are just rumors. It was a bad week for getting a doctorate after a new survey by the National Science Foundation found that only 64% of students graduating with a science or engineering PhD had found jobs, the lowest level in a decade. It was a bad week for the miracle of Hanukkah after a rabbi became stranded 20 feet in the air in a cherry picker after lighting a giant electric menorah in New Rochelle, New York. When there was no divine intervention, he had to be rescued by firefighters. And it was a bad week for oversharing after millionaire real estate investor Mark Paskin, who is 63, put up a billboard in San Diego saying, "All I want for Christmas is a Latina girlfriend." After it sparked protests for being creepy, the billboard was destroyed by vandals. And now we'll turn to the briefing section from the Week magazine for this week. It is entitled Fixing the Safety Net. As baby boomers retire and health costs soar, Medicare and Social Security are devouring the federal budget. Are the entitlement programs in trouble? Not immediately, but spending on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security is on an unsustainable trajectory, eating up an ever larger chunk of the federal budget and adding to the government's ballooning deficit. Today, 46% of the government's non-interest spending goes to the three safety net programs. By 2030, they will consume 61%, thanks to retiring baby boomers and skyrocketing medical costs. Even if you love these entitlement programs, at some point they begin to crowd out everything else, said Tim Penny, a former congressman who served on President George W. Bush's Social Security Commission. There's an immorality to that. Would it help to raise the retirement age? Some say that's only fair since we're living longer, but it may not help much. According to the Congressional Budget Office, gradually raising Medicare's eligibility age from 65 to 67 would save about $148 billion through 2021. but would only reduce Medicare costs by about 5% over the longer term. That's because 65- and 66-year-olds are relatively healthy and cost Medicare the least of all beneficiaries. Social Security's full retirement age is already headed toward 67. If it were further pushed to 70, spending would decline by about 13% by 2060. But some economists have argued that such a change would disproportionately hurt lower- and middle-income Americans, since increases in life expectancy are concentrated among the affluent, and less well-off seniors rely more on the safety net programs. What about limiting benefits for the well-off? Means testing Social Security won't save much, since just 2% of Social Security benefits go to seniors with annual incomes of over $100,000. A study last year by the Center for Economic and Policy Research concluded that denying or lowering benefits to the wealthy would have little or no effect on the long-term viability of Social Security. Medicare, by contrast, has been means-tested since 2003. People making more than $85,000 a year, $170,000 for couples, pay higher premiums for doctor services, and as a result of Obamacare, some affluent beneficiaries now pay more for prescription drugs. But a study by the Kaiser Family Foundation concluded that even more rigorous means testing of Medicare benefits would save only $36 billion through 2019. Democrats worry that if wealthier Americans don't benefit from Medicare, they'll turn against it altogether. "I don't want to see Medicare turn into a welfare program," said Representative Keith Ellison, a Democrat from Minnesota. What other reforms might help? Social Security can pay full benefits through 2033 without any changes, and studies suggest that relatively modest changes would put it on sound financial footing for years to come. Changing the formula for annual cost of living increases could save more than $100 billion over the next decade. Social Security does not currently levy payroll taxes on income over $110,100. Simply removing that ceiling would close the program's solvency gap for the next 75 years. But Medicare is a different story. Retiring baby boomers will swell the rolls of recipients from 49 million today to 80 million by 2030, and Medicare spending is rising even more steeply. It's projected to double to $1.1 trillion by 2022 from $560 billion last year. President Obama has argued that the best way to keep Medicare solvent is to bring health care costs under control through government oversight and more efficient delivery of care. Republicans would like to reduce costs by giving beneficiaries a fixed sum to pay for private insurance premiums, which they say would foster more competition and push prices down. Why haven't the programs been fixed already? Well, most Americans say that they want to reduce the deficit, but no one believes their own benefits should be cut or taxes raised. Voters almost always oppose the kinds of major reforms that would make entitlement programs more solvent, and politicians know they will be punished for suggesting them. As a result, elected officials keep kicking the can down the road. Now, however, there are members of Congress on both sides of the aisle who say it's time to stop pretending that these programs are sustainable without reform. "Those who say don't touch entitlements aren't dealing with reality," said Senator Kent Conrad, a Democrat from North Dakota, chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. Could reforms happen now? Republicans have said they will only agree to tax increases in the fiscal cliff negotiations if major changes to entitlements are made. So far, they haven't specified what those changes should be, and liberal Democrats have pushed back hard against cuts in Social Security and Medicare. But during last year's failed debt ceiling negotiations, President Obama reportedly offered Republicans several entitlement compromises, including an increase in the eligibility age for Medicare and tighter cost of living increases for Social Security benefits. those offers could return to the table. Entitlements are eating up the entire budget, said Jim Kessler of the moderate Democratic think tank Third Way. We've got to figure out a way to afford the safety net we've spent a century trying to create. And the footnote to this briefing, entitled Fixing the Safety Net, is called The Political Perils of Reform. Tampering with entitlements can be hazardous to a politician's health. In 1989, Representative Dan Rostenkowski, a Democrat from Illinois, then the powerful chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, was chased down a Chicago street by elderly constituents furious over his support for the Medicare Catastrophic Coverage Act. Designed to protect seniors from catastrophic medical expenses, the act passed with bipartisan support in Congress, but some seniors were outraged that it was to be financed by a surtax paid by the wealthiest 40% of beneficiaries. With the crowd shouting, "Coward!" and "Impeach!", Rostenkowski had to cut through a nearby gas station and sprint to his waiting car. One elderly protester threw herself on the hood to prevent his escape. That was the first signal a lot of us had that this was really a third rail, said Rostenkowski's longtime press secretary, Jim Jaffe. 3 months later, the act was repealed. And now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. in the Week magazine for this week. Our first column is entitled, Can Obama Escape the Curse? By Dick Pohlman in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Every reelected president faces the second-term curse, said Dick Pohlman. Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton all suffered major scandals after falling prey to hubris and weary cynicism. While George W. Bush misinterpreted his reelection as a mandate for privatizing Social Security and fighting on in Iraq. A similar fate now awaits Barack Obama, should he succumb to the temptation to interpret his reelection as a mandate for sweeping change. True, Obama won rather decisively and now has the whip hand in his battle with Republicans over taxes and the budget. But in our still divided nation, such ideological leverage is short-lived. At best, Obama has 18 months to push his agenda. His liberal base is clamoring for grand initiatives on issues like climate change. But by 2014, Republicans will have regrouped, and if history is any guide, Democrats will likely take a beating in the congressional midterms. Soon afterward, everyone will be chattering about 2016, easing Obama further into lame duck mode. As Nixon once observed, second terms are almost inevitably downhill. Obama could defy the odds, but only if he doesn't overreach. The next column is entitled, The End of Illegal Immigration, by Michael Barone in NationalReview.com. Mass migration from Mexico may be a thing of the past, said Michael Barone. Between 1995 and 2000, 2.2 million Mexicans crossed into the U.S. in search of work, sparking a major debate over illegal immigration. But from 2005 to 2010, the influx into the U.S. essentially halted. In fact, 20,000 more Mexicans left the U.S. than arrived here. The reason is simple. Immigrants were badly hurt by the recession, the huge spike in unemployment, and the bursting of the housing bubble. Many of the subprime mortgages sold prior to 2008 went to Latino immigrants, who suddenly found themselves in deep debt and without a job. With their dreams dashed, many Mexicans began to self-deport, in Mitt Romney's chilly phrase. When they returned home, they told their sad cautionary stories. That's why I doubt that as the economy rebounds, mass Mexican migration will resume. Despite the headlines about the drug war in Mexico, it is rapidly becoming a middle-class country whose economy is growing faster than ours. Mexicans have discovered there is no paradise in El Norte, so they've stopped coming, probably for good. And the third column here is entitled, Why We Can't Discuss Gun Violence, by Timothy Egan in nytimes.com. What's the most forbidden topic in America? Asked Timothy Egan. It's not sex or religion, it's gun violence. We are the most armed society in the world, with more than 300 million guns in private hands and 9,146 gun homicides in 2009, a rate nearly 20 times higher than that of other supposedly civilized countries. But don't bring that up. Sports broadcaster Bob Costas learned that lesson last week when he said that Kansas City Chiefs linebacker Jovan Belcher, who murdered his girlfriend and killed himself after an argument, would probably be alive if he hadn't owned a gun. The gun censors on the right immediately went ballistic, telling him to shut up and demanding his resignation or firing. Why? Because Costas spoke a simple truth. Studies show that a gun in a family's home is 12 times more likely to result in the death of a household member than of an intruder. It also increases the chance of suicide. For the gun lobby, these facts are unmentionables because they dispel the illusion that guns make you safer. In this country, the First Amendment does not apply to the Second Amendment. The irony, of course, in this particular reading of this commentary is the terrible tragedy that happened in Connecticut this past week. That, of course, happened after the Week magazine for this week went to press. So there's been a lot in the news about it. I know that you're already well aware of it. We'll have more details and more retrospective, I am sure, in next week's edition of the Week magazine. And now we'll flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week for the column entitled The Last Word. And this week, the Last Word column is entitled Where Women Have No Choice. For an Afghan girl dreading marriage to a man she hates, says Kevin Seif, death is often the only escape. Just before she leapt from her roof into the streets of Kabul, Farima thought of the wedding that would never happen and the man she would never marry. Her fiancé would be pleased to see her die, she later recalled, thinking it would offer relief to them both. Farima, 17, had resisted her engagement to Zabullah since it was ordained by her grandfather when she was 9 years old. In post-Taliban Kabul, where she walked to school and dreamed of becoming a doctor, she still clawed against a fate dictated by ritual. After 11 years of Western intervention in Afghanistan, a woman's right to study and work had long since been codified by the government. Modernity had crept into Afghan's capital, Farima thought, but not far enough to save her from a forced marriage to a man she despised. Farima's father, Mohammed, was eating breakfast when he heard her body hit the dirt like a tiny explosion. He ran outside. His daughter's torso was contorted. Her back was broken, but she was still alive. In a quick burst of consciousness, Farima recognized that she had survived. It was God's providence, she thought. It was a miracle she hadn't prayed for, but it left her without an escape. Suddenly, she was a mangled version of herself, still desperate to avoid the marriage her family had ordered. She didn't know it yet, but her survival meant that she would become a test case in one of her country's newest and most troubled experiments in modernity, a divorce court guided by Afghanistan's version of Islamic Sharia law. Could a disabled teenager navigate a legal system still stacked against women? We still must get married, Zabullah told his brother when he heard about Farima's suicide attempt. The engagement must remain. Her father agreed that Farima's pursuit of a separation was unwise. We are not a liberal family, Mohammed said. This is not how we handle our problems. When her marriage was fixed, a 9-year-old Farima crawled into her mother's lap, confused about what it meant to be engaged. Even as Kabul grew more modern, that traditional engagement was unbreakable, her parents told her. The man she was destined to spend her life with was a distant cousin. If the marriage didn't happen, the family could splinter. But when Farima got to know Zabula, she couldn't stand him. They talked on the phone, and he chastised her for venturing outside her home. He demanded that she stop speaking, even with members of her family. She was too close with her relatives, getting ice cream and going to the market with her father's cousin, he said. If he was like that when we were engaged, what would marriage have been like? Farima said. I couldn't bear it. Less than a minute after Farima hit the ground, Mohammed scooped up his daughter. He hailed a taxi, and they sped to Ali Ahmed Hospital, where Tahir Jan Khalili performed surgery for 3 hours. The family was ashamed to tell Khalili the truth. Her father said Farima had fallen by accident. I wasn't sure if she would survive. Her back was badly broken, Khalili said. In the past year, he has handled nearly a dozen attempted female suicides. Farima spent 9 days in the hospital, flickering in and out of consciousness. When she re-entered the world in late September, bandaged and carried on a stretcher, her relatives cried and thanked God that she had survived. But if not death, then what? Farima thought. Zabula, a plumber, was insistent that the wedding date remain unchanged. He had spent $30,000 on gifts for his fiancée, he said. He had paid for a big engagement party during which Farima had sat sullen for hours while relatives sang and danced and ate kebab. Everyone was having a great night, but she did not, Mohammed said. Dozens of women in Afghanistan kill themselves each year to escape failed and often violent marriages. Those tragedies are widely mourned, but they nonetheless offer a resolution recognized by Islamic law. A woman's death, even by her own hand, marks the end of a marriage or engagement. Women who run away face prison sentences of several years. A failed suicide is more complicated to untangle. When Farima awoke in the hospital, bruised and broken, her wedding had not yet been canceled. Nearly all of her relatives expected her to follow through with the marriage. She gave up on the prospect of another suicide attempt. She could not walk without assistance and was too weak to inflict much damage on herself. The girl accused of being too modern would make another modern decision. She opted to resolve her failing engagement in Kabul's nascent family court. She would have to plead her case in front of a room full of judges and lawyers who would decide whether she was entitled to a separation. In traditional Afghan culture, men can divorce their wives without the approval of any justice system. 2 months after she left the hospital, her mother and father helped carry her to the third floor of the family court, a faded yellow guest house where a line of burqa-clad women are nearly always waiting outside. Farima wore a black headscarf. Her skin was pallid. She hadn't been outside in weeks, spending most of her time reading novels in her room. The chief judge, Rahima Rasai, looked across the room at Farima while she adjusted her back brace. "You have ruined your life," Rasai said. "The court is a place where a woman is entitled to plead for divorce or custody of her children, but only if she has five male witnesses or defenders, and only if her husband or fiancé condones the separation. The court is funded by Western organizations, but adheres strictly to Sharia law." Farima sat on the opposite side of the room from her fiancé. She looked at the judge and tried hard not to cry. Every year, Kabul's family court handles about 300 cases, mostly women seeking to divorce their negligent or abusive husbands. Established in 2003, it was seen widely as a leap of progress after the Taliban stoning of adulterers and dismantling of women's rights. Women whose fiancés emigrated from Afghanistan line up to seek separation from absent partners. Girls whose husbands sold them as prostitutes sink into the court's cushioned chairs, begging for divorce certificates stamped with the government insignia. Last month was a typical one at the court. Some women screamed at their husbands. Some brought their small children to testify. Some beat themselves with their fists to demonstrate the abuse they had endured. Some watched as their husbands were dragged out in handcuffs. Some arrived in burkas and some in blue jeans. Many were crying as they left the courtroom. On Farima's day in court, her father sat in the corner of the room. For years he had been trying to avoid this moment. "I told my daughter not to do this. We don't want a bad name. We don't want our family to fall apart," Mohammed said. Farima had told him many times that she was thinking about killing herself, he said. When he looked at her, crumpled and frail, he knew what he could have prevented. "I just never thought she would really do it," he said. "What is wrong with this man?" Rasai asked Farima, pointing to Zabula. "He treats me terribly," Farima said. "Our marriage would be hell." Then the judge looked to Zabula. He wanted badly not to be there, objecting to the whole idea of a family court. "She is confused," he said. "She has become so liberal," he said. There was a hush in the courtroom. Rasai sipped her tea. She was tired. It was the last case of the morning. Already the court had heard four women pleading for divorce and protracted arguments over dowry compensation and physical abuse. None of those cases had been resolved. There weren't enough male witnesses, or Rasai wasn't convinced that a separation was warranted. She is reluctant to grant too many. "It haunts me even when I'm praying. I think about the sadness of my job," Rasai said later. Although she is one of Afghanistan's few female judges, Rasai is hardly a Western-style advocate of women's rights. She sometimes recommends that men subdue their wives. Even in seemingly clear-cut cases of domestic abuse, she often resists defendants' initial pleas for separation. When Rasai finally spoke again, she asked Farima what gifts Zabula had given her for her engagement. Farima's mother left the courtroom and returned dragging a metal trunk full of clothes, jewelry, and cosmetics. Her mother pulled out one item at a time and held it above her head for the court to see. "Where are the other rings?" Zabula burst out. "That's all that you gave me," Farima replied, exasperated. "Even if Karzai demands it, I will not allow my daughter to marry this man." Farima's mother suddenly exclaimed. It was the kind of support Farima had never received from her parents. Rasai started scribbling. "Your engagement is scrapped," she said. "You no longer have any relation to each other." Farima looked defiant, but she did not smile. She and Zabula dipped their thumbs in ink and touched them to certificates pronouncing their separation. "Keep this with you forever," Rasai said, giving each a copy. Farima's parents helped carry her down the stairs. She had lived to get what her family had denied her. Her Afghanistan again showed a flash of modern promise. "I have defended my rights," Farima said in the lobby. Her mother was crying. 2 weeks later, Farima was back to spending her days at home. She was reading a book called The Gift of the Bride. "It's about relationships between wives and husbands and children," she said. She was no longer attending school. Her father and brothers had asked her to stop during her engagement, and they would not allow her to return. Farima was still basking in the court's judgment, but it left her feeling unmoored. Even in the country's most developed city, opportunities are limited for a single woman unable to walk on her own. "I'm worried that no one will marry my daughter now," her mother said. "Zabula is sure that he will marry another woman. He has a trunk full of gifts ready for her." Farima has started considering the prospect of a life alone in her childhood bedroom. "I'm not sure what I will do," she said. "I'm not sure what I can do." In the Afghanistan of her novels, the girls grow up to be happy and marriages are full of love. Husbands are patient and accepting. "For me, it is not always like that," Farima said. "Life is complicated." And that article was written in 2012 by The Washington Post. Now we'll turn to the health and science section from the Week magazine for this week. The first article is entitled, "The Stuff of Life on Mercury." Mercury, the closest planet to the Sun, has blistering 800-degree temperatures at its equator, but its poles are full of ice. New data from NASA's Messenger spacecraft, which began orbiting Mercury last year, has revealed that as much as a trillion tons of ice exists in shadowy polar craters, where temperatures can drop to minus 370 degrees. Much of the ice appears to be covered in carbon-based organic compounds, some of the same ingredients that may have led to life on Earth, UCLA planetary scientist David Page tells Reuters.com. Millions of years ago, icy asteroids and comets collided with Mercury, seeding the planet with ice and organic compounds, the same process scientists believe that made Earth a watery planet. Mercury's environment has long been considered too hostile for life, but the new observations have raised the question of whether any regions on or within Mercury might have both liquid water and organic compounds. Somewhere between the poles and the equator, Mercury might have milder regions that are more hospitable, especially just below its surface. Researcher Maria Zuber of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology said it's not likely that life exists on Mercury, but the fact that even such an inhospitable planet contains both water and organics raises the possibility that life could occur someplace else. The next article here is entitled, A Tap Water Danger? Chemicals used to purify tap water may be causing food allergy rates to skyrocket in the U.S., a new study suggests. Researchers at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine tested the urine of more than 2,000 people for dichlorophenols, chemicals found in chlorine-treated tap water, and in pesticides used on many fruits and vegetables. They found that people with the highest levels of dichlorophenols in their bodies were 80% more likely to have food allergies, most commonly to eggs, milk, peanuts, wheat, soy, and shellfish than those with the lowest levels. Over the past 15 years, food allergy rates have increased nearly 20% in the U.S. More than 3 million children younger than 18 have allergies with reactions that range from mild to deadly. While the study does not allow concluding that pesticides are responsible for the allergies, it certainly raises the possibility, Kenneth Spaeth, an expert on environmental pollutants at North Shore University Hospital on Long Island, New York, tells ABCNews.com. Researchers think that Americans' increased exposure to dichlorophenols may be killing off healthy bacteria in the gut that help the immune system function properly, causing it to attack otherwise harmless proteins in food. The next item, Africa's disappearing lions. Africa's lions are dwindling toward extinction at an alarming rate, Duke University researchers say. Using new high-resolution satellite data from Google Earth, they've discovered that the savanna habitat that lions need to survive has shrunk by 75% over the past 50 years and is far more fragmented than conservationists previously realized. Over the same period, the lion population is thought to have declined by two-thirds, from 100,000 animals to fewer than 35,000. Those in West Africa are in particularly bad shape, study author Stuart Pym tells NBCNews.com. Fewer than 500 lions remain there, where the human population has doubled in the last three decades. Only about 24,000 African lions live in areas where they have space to roam and are safe from hunters, including farmers who often kill them to protect their livestock. Elsewhere, the species is at a risk of disappearing. The stunning and grim discovery that Africa's savannas and lions are nearly gone, says Thomas Lovejoy, a conservationist at George Mason University, emphasizes the urgency for conservation of these great habitats. And the health scare of the week, too much running backfires. Running too far, too fast, especially in middle age, may take years off your life instead of improving your health. A new review of research shows that while regular runners lower their risk of early death by nearly 20% compared with non-runners, running more than 20 miles a week can actually be harmful and lead to cardiac damage. Running too fast at a pace faster than 8 minutes a mile also seems to stress the heart. After age 50, pushing too hard is probably not good for one's heart or longevity, James O'Keefe, a sports cardiologist at St. Luke's MidAmerica Heart Institute in Kansas City, tells the Wall Street Journal. A growing body of research shows that extreme exercise can harden the coronary artery, a condition typically seen in people who are completely sedentary. Endurance athletes such as marathoners and triathletes also appear to be at higher risk of atrial fibrillation, a heart arrhythmia responsible for 1 in 3 strokes. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section in the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled, The Tea Party. Is the Rebellion Over? Is the Tea Party dead? Asked Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. The conservative movement launched in 2009 was rocked last week by a series of disputes, departures, and signs that the GOP establishment is ready to abandon it. Former Representative Dick Armey quit his position as head of the organization Freedom Works, one of the pillars of the Tea Party movement, citing internal mismanagement. 4 Tea Party-backed congressmen were booted off House committees by Speaker John Boehner for repeatedly refusing to toe the party line. Most significantly of all, the movement's patron saint in Congress, Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, announced he would resign his seat to head up conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. Whisper it quietly, said David Brooks in the New York Times, but the Tea Party mania has passed. In the wake of the voters' rebuke in November, the far-right extremists who consider compromise a form of surrender are retreating to even more marginal oasis of purity, leaving an opening for a new generation of kinder, gentler Republicans, such as Senator Marco Rubio. Establishment conservatives like David Brooks have never understood the Tea Party, said Daniel Foster in NationalReview.com. The coalition of grassroots activists is too diffuse and contradictory to be talked about as a monolith. Its only mania is a healthy concern about the ever-expanding government. Yes, the movement has some kooks and cranks, but it was Tea Party-aligned conservatives who drove the electoral wave of 2010, and their small government passion made stars of Republican upstarts such as Rubio, Chris Christie, and Rand Paul. Reports of the Tea Party's death are highly premature. And the next item, marijuana, Obama's legalization dilemma. As a teenager, Barack Obama not only inhaled when he smoked marijuana, he was the leader of a group of heavy-duty stoners called the Chum Gang. But as president, said Charlie Savage in the New York Times, Obama is the man charged with enforcing federal law. That presents him with an interesting conundrum now that voters in Colorado and Washington have approved the recreational use of marijuana in those states. Marijuana remains illegal under the Federal Controlled Substances Act of 1970. Rather than surrender its authority, Obama's Justice Department is considering busting a few low-level marijuana users in Colorado and Washington so as to create a court challenge, knowing that federal law trumps the state one. For Obama, victory would be politically risky, said Patrick Johnson in CSMonitor.com. Striking down those state laws would be seen as the height of hypocrisy and a betrayal of the millions of pro-weed millennials who voted for him. Voters have been sold a bill of goods on this issue, said Kevin Sabat in CNN.com. Supporters tell us they will regulate and control marijuana use, even among teens. But we face the prospect of a re-energized big tobacco moving into this lucrative market and commercializing and promoting marijuana to kids. New vice taxes on pot, we're told, will offset society's costs. But the $40 billion we get annually from cigarette and alcohol users is but a tenth of the losses in productivity, premature illness, accidents, and death. Legalizing pot would also do nothing to curb the Mexican drug cartels, said Keegan Hamilton in TheAtlantic.com. The cartels long ago diversified their portfolios to include cocaine, crystal meth, and heroin, so legalized weed in two states won't hurt them one bit. And now a few short items with the last few minutes we have here. As the U.S. draws down its forces, American deaths in Afghanistan have fallen sharply, from 500 in 2010 to 301 so far this year. The number of U.S. troops in the country has dropped from 100,000 to 68,000 as Afghan security forces take over much of the fighting with the Taliban. Thanks to the presidential election, socialism and capitalism are the two most looked-up words of the year, said dictionary publisher Merriam-Webster. They're words that sort of encapsulate the zeitgeist, said editor-at-large Pete Soklowski. And more than 20 million Americans, 8.7% of all adults, now practice yoga, according to a new study by Yoga Journal, including the cost of classes, clothes, equipment, and other accessories. They spend $10.3 billion a year on their practice. And women now make up one-third of all the lawyers and doctors in the United States. In 1970, women represented only 9.7% of the nation's doctors and less than 4.9% of its lawyers. And the poll watch for this week, 70% of Americans say they would like to see elected leaders compromise to reach a deal in the fiscal cliff negotiations. 18% say they want leaders to stick to their principles. And 64% say the federal government should not intervene in states where weed has been legalized by the voters. And we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And I'd like to take this opportunity to wish you a very, very Merry Christmas or Happy Hanukkah and a wonderful, wonderful New Year. Of course, we'll be back with our program next week. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and happy holidays.